Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Taunton. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fifth look at the life and crimes of Ted Bundy. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. You can also go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, and follow the show. All right, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back, relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last year in the fall of 1975. Bundy is currently sitting in jail awaiting trial for the kidnapping and attempted felonious assault of Carol Durantia. He has an idea that investigators in Washington are looking into him for the series of Ted murders the previous year. He is also aware that investigators in Colorado are heavily looking at him for a series of murders that had taken place there. Bundy continues to assert his innocence on all fronts, telling anyone who will listen that he was not responsible for them, and also that he had never been to Colorado. That the brochures that had been found inside of his apartment were in fact left there by a friend. And basically putting up this smokescreen of supreme confidence, and that's something that Ted Bundy is going to become known for, this ego-driven sense of self-importance and intelligence. While Bundy is putting all of this out to his friends and family, he's unaware that investigators in Colorado have in fact tracked his movements throughout their state, because Bundy used a gas credit card to purchase fuel when he was there. On the days that the various women went missing, but also within very close proximity to where they had gone missing. And this is something that's going to come back to haunt Bundy again and again in the years to come. He has this obsessive-compulsive fear of running out of fuel, and because of this, he will oftentimes stop and only throw a few dollars inside of the car or other vehicle that he's driving. And this will show investigators that he was indeed in their jurisdiction when the crime that they're happened to be investigating took place. It wasn't only investigators in Colorado and Utah who were investigating Bundy. Washington state authorities were also looking into him quite heavily for the Ted murders, and they were requesting pretty much everything that they could get on Bundy. His school transcripts, various employment records, really anything. And because of this, they were able to get their hands on his phone records, and they learned that on the night of November 20th, 1974, one of these phone calls was to crime author and friend of Bundy, Ann Rule. Now, Rule was in the hospital at the time, and her mother later stated the caller refused to give his name and seemed very agitated and upset. The next phone call Bundy is known to have made was to his ex-fiance's family in Northern California, and also to a residence in Oakland, California. The residence of this home had no idea who Ted Bundy was. And Rule and law enforcement later speculated that it may have been Bundy reaching out for help, that he was spiraling at this point and unable to control the urges that he was having, and that he had reached out to all of these individuals kind of as a safety net to try and rein him back in and possibly even to confess to the things that he has been doing. These same investigators in Washington State did a thorough search on areas connected with Bundy, including the rooming house that he had lived in for a number of years. Bundy's family, however, would not cooperate with law enforcement and refused to allow them access to their home or the grounds on which they lived. And authorities were really at a dead end as far as this went, because without probable cause and an idea of what they may be looking for, in this case, mementos of the missing girls and their murders, they cannot get a search warrant to force a search of the family property. They also learned that his fiancée, Elizabeth Kopfler, had found a hatchet under the front seat of Bundy's car, and that he had given her some explanation or another as to the reason why it was under there, although she didn't particularly buy it. And the hatchet being underneath the front seat greatly disturbed her. They also learned that Elizabeth was disturbed by the fact that Bundy kept two pairs of mechanics overalls along with a toolbox in the trunk of his car. And further, they learned that Bundy had connections to various crime scenes away from Seattle. Bundy had a friend who worked at Olympia State College and stayed with this individual on a number of occasions. And that Bundy had told Elizabeth on July 7th, 1974, that friends had invited him to a party at Lake Semmerich, where they were going to be water skiing. Now, numerous people who knew Bundy from his political activities were indeed at the state park that day. However, they told a much different story to authorities, that they had been there water skiing and had seen Bundy walking alone on the beach and had approached him asking if he wanted to partake of the festivities, which Bundy promptly declined. Bundy is known to have been with Elizabeth and her parents on the night of May 31st when Brenda Ball disappeared. He took them out for pizza, dropping them all back at Elizabeth's home fairly early. Now, remember, Brenda disappeared somewhere around 2 a.m. from the Flame Tavern, an area that it was later learned Bundy was very familiar with. And that the following day, Bundy had attended Elizabeth's daughter's baptism and afterwards gone back with them to the house, where Bundy had been extremely tired and fallen asleep on the floor. They then learned from Elizabeth of a woman who Bundy had had a relationship with in 1972. And this woman, who was from an upper-class background, said that Bundy did not feel as though he fit in with her or the class of people that she was associated with, and that she'd had no real interest in Bundy beyond this brief relationship, stating that they'd only had sexual intercourse one time and that it was anything other than kind, warm, and loving. This woman stated that sometime in the spring of 1972, she and Bundy had gone out on a picnic near a lake, that she had drunken a considerable amount of wine, and Bundy seemed to take great pleasure in taking her down to the water and dunking her head under the water repeatedly as he attempted to undo the top of her bikini. When this became
too difficult, Bundy ends up simply ripping the woman's bikini bottom off and having sex with her. With his forearm pressed against her throat, she's unable to breathe. She keeps trying to get him to stop. Bundy does not listen and continues to have sex with her until he finishes. Another story that came out to detectives during this period of time was Bundy taking a group of women on a rafting trip in 1973 and forcing one of the women to tube down the area that they were rafting, which was an extremely dangerous area, refusing to allow her to get onto the raft with the rest of their party. Those involved stated that Bundy had been fairly jovial and easygoing throughout the day until at some point, as they're on the water, his demeanor completely changed and he became cold, elusive, and withdrawn, at which point he had turned on this woman. Other stories like this continued to come out concerning Ted Bundy. He had a history of sneaking up on women from behind and scaring them, or of leaping out of places indoors on women that he knew in order to terrify them. Again, this is in stark contrast to the public image that Bundy would put forth for years and years and years. And again, according to Ann Rule, she had had one such encounter with Bundy months from the point in time that we're talking about, where Bundy and she were in a tavern having lunch and drinks. She went to the bathroom, came back, and Bundy was suddenly behind her, tapping her on the shoulder. She stated that he seemed to take great pleasure from. Another individual that officers spoke to during this period of time was an elderly woman who had known Bundy when he worked at the yacht club. She was a patron of this yacht club, and Bundy had befriended her. She described him as a manipulative schemer, although officers noted she was very affectionate of Bundy, pointing out to the officers various places that he had lived during the time that she had known him, and letting them know that she had treated him almost like a grandson, lending her car, money, china, anything really that Ted would ask her for. Officers did learn that this woman had seen Bundy at least twice during 1974. In fact, during the early part of the summer of 1974, she stated that she had seen Ted and he had had a cast on his arm, something that would not come out for many, many years. Was that Bundy had tenuous links at least to some of his victims, which, when we think of serial killers, is nearly unheard of. Most of the time when you think of a serial killer and their victims, you think of individuals like Richard Ramirez or Edmund Kemper or Dean Corll, who really did not know their victims. Bundy, at least tentatively and never conclusively proven, was at least aware of some of his victims, such as Linda Ann Healy, who knew his cousin Jane through connections that they'd had together during college. And this cousin, while not willing to incriminate Ted in any way, shape, or form, could not conclusively tell investigators that Bundy had never, in fact, met Linda Ann Healy. Another individual officers spoke to was Jane's brother, Scott, who stated that he and Ted had often gone hiking, specifically in the area around Taylor Mountain. Now, Scott would not help investigators until he was served with a subpoena, at which point he drove officers to the various places that Bundy and he had gone hiking in, one of which was very close to the Taylor Mountain.
as with many crimes of this magnitude, far from helping investigators in their search for clues, witnesses, etc., the media actually hampered the investigators' search, as with the publication of Bundy's name and mugshot, reporters in Washington began going and showing pictures of Bundy to potential witnesses from the various disappearances, most notably the Lake Skamarish witnesses. Number of them were shown Bundy's mugshot, and this contaminated them, as when officers finally got to sit down and talk with them again, they immediately picked Bundy up and said, "That's the guy. Are you sure?" Yeah, then they were forced to admit that the media had contacted them and shown them Bundy's picture prior to their meeting with the officers. There were a few witnesses, though, who were not contaminated by the media saturation and proliferation of Ted Bundy's picture, who were able to pick him out of mugshot lineups as the man they had seen at various times when women had gone missing. This was, in fact, a boon to the investigators' case. However, the problem investigators faced was it wasn't a crime for someone to be in an area, and as Bundy had not been convicted of any murders, they couldn't take those murder convictions to their own jurisdiction and use them as proof of histrionic attacks committed by him, which would then possibly enable the officers to go after Bundy. Instead, they had a mountain of circumstantial evidence that was growing bigger by the day, but their hands were tied. One of these individuals is the only known person to possibly have seen Bundy when he was in the actual act of murder, or just prior to or just after. This was a district attorney's son who was driving back from Ellensburg on the evening that Susan Rancourt went missing. He saw a Volkswagen Bug and its driver pulled over to the side of the road near the Taylor Mountain site, and the taillights were on the vehicle. This individual positively ID'd Bundy as the individual he'd seen that night, again, giving further credence to the investigators' belief that Bundy was indeed responsible for the horrific crimes in their area. One case that is rarely mentioned involving Bundy that Anne Rule attempted to link to him in her book The Stranger Beside Me was a rape that took place in 1974 just down the street from the boarding house that Ted Bundy was living in. The young woman had been awoken in the middle of the night to someone standing in her doorway wearing a watch cap pulled down over his face with eye slits cut into it, t-shirt and jeans. The man had taped the woman's eyes, raped her, and then taped her wrists and feet together as he made her getaway. She heard him run out of the house and then his footsteps running off in the distance. This has never been linked officially to Bundy, but at the time of the investigation, officers highly suspected that, given the circumstances, the time of night that it occurred, and the proximity to where Ted Bundy was living, it was very probable that he had committed this. As they had done at the beginning of their investigation when they drew up a list of things that all of these disappearances had in common, now with Bundy a possible suspect, officers drew up a list of things that they believe connected him to these crimes. Bundy was known to often wear white tennis outfits. He was familiar with the Taylor Mountain area. He bore a striking resemblance to the man seen at the Lake Skamarish, who introduced himself to various women as Ted. He drove a Volkswagen Bug. He lived within a mile of three of the victims. He had the knife from his girlfriend's car, the lug wrench, the meat cleaver, surgical rubber gloves, and unexplained women's clothing in his possession. He missed work in the days prior to and the days after the Lake Samish disappearances. He was unaccountable for at the time of each one of the disappearances. He had pantyhose in the glove compartment of his car. He often traveled between Seattle and Olympia, Washington. He had a preference for women with long, dark hair that was parted in the middle. He had violently choked at least two women during consensual sexual encounters. He had a propensity to go from warm and outgoing to cold and antagonistic in the blink of an eye. He enjoyed frightening women. He was known to wear a... He'd been arrested with what would later become termed as a kill kit in his possession when he was pulled over in Utah. And credit card slips had placed him in the direct vicinity where women had gone missing in both Colorado and Utah. Again, this is all circumstantial evidence. Great to get a bead on a suspect, but unfortunately, it is not enough to build a case against Ted Bundy, not without any form of real physical evidence. Officers from the various states met and conferred with each other at least once during the period of Bundy's initial incarceration, where really they just compared notes with one another and noted the similarities in all of the various cases, as well as the things that they knew about Ted Bundy. On November 20th, 1975, Ted Bundy was freed on $15,000 bail, and he immediately headed back to the Seattle area. His fiance, Elizabeth, was absolutely terrified of him, but very quickly, the two of them became inseparable once again. Seattle detectives began trailing Bundy anywhere that they went. Such was their conviction that he was, in fact, the man responsible for the Ted murders. Bundy oftentimes found it humorous that these men were following him. Others, though, he found it quite perturbing and insulting to him. Bundy would joke with friends and family alike that the officers trailing him were not doing a very good job. He was quickly able to make their cars and elude them. He also found it quite entertaining, much as John Wayne Gacy did, to go out and confront the individuals, sometimes asking them to go get drinks with him or if they would like something to eat. On Monday, February 23rd, 1976, Ted Bundy's trial in the kidnapping and attempted assault of Carol Durancha officially got underway. Bundy had chosen to forego a jury trial and instead allowed the judge to act as both the judge and the jury in his case. It's interesting to note that Carol Durancha was very nervous and shaky on the stand. Part of this had to do with the fact that Ted Bundy was working as part of his own legal defense team and was able to cross-examine her as she was on the stand. Bundy himself took the stand in his own defense.
On Monday, March 1st, the judge found Ted Bundy guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of aggravated kidnapping. The interesting thing here is that the judge did not hand down a sentence. Bundy was looking at the possibility of life behind bars.
And eventually he is going to be sentenced, but reality is this particular sentencing really bears no importance to the Ted Bundy saga. He ends up being sent to state prison, where at first his mentality is one of a broken and enraged man, and before vacillating to the old arrogant Ted Bundy of old, he ends up becoming pretty much a prison lawyer, helping other inmates with their own legal defense. And at one point, he ends up getting caught with what's called an escape kit. He had a woman's social security card and what officials deemed to be materials used to make a fake ID. This ends up getting Bundy 15 days in solitary confinement. While Ted is in prison, he ends up being sent to a medical unit where they do various tests in an effort to try and figure out his mental state of mind. Obviously, Bundy, as a psychology major, is able to get through these exams without really revealing his true self. He ends up being found sane, and on June 30th, Bundy is officially sentenced 1 to 15 years, which basically meant, with good behavior, which Bundy was more than capable of exhibiting should he choose to, he could have been out in less than 2 years. In Colorado, with Bundy officially having been sentenced, officials were scrambling to put together a case against him. It was known in law enforcement circles that the crowbar found in Bundy's possession when he was arrested initially in Utah was a almost perfect match for indentations found in Karen Campbell's skull, although later this is going to be argued pretty heavily in court. As he would often do during his various incarcerations, Bundy would rail against what he perceived as a screw job by the system. This time he felt that the psychiatrists and medical staff who had evaluated him had been swayed by the judge who had convicted and sentenced Bundy. And he would often speak scornfully of this man when months prior, just before the trial began and even during it, he spoke glowingly of him, insisting that he believed he could get a fair trial from this judge. And you're going to see this time and again with Ted Bundy. Anytime he has a legal setback or is convicted, he swings between, oh, this is a very fair situation, to the sons of bitches railroaded me and screwed me over. And that's really the essence of Ted Bundy that is often overlooked. He could never take responsibility for his own actions. Didn't matter what it was. Anytime Ted was caught having done wrong by anyone, it was not his fault, or he hadn't done it, but people had swayed those in power to believe he had done it. And he continues this almost up until the day he dies. However, I will put a footnote there, even as he's insisting after conviction for numerous murders that he, you know, didn't do these things, he's also touting himself as the best expert in serial killers in the world, and in fact admitting to numerous homicides. On October 22nd, 1975, Ted Bundy is officially charged with the murder of Karen Campbell in Pitkin County, Colorado. Officially extradited on January 28th, 1976. And what's going to come from Ted's extradition is really the stuff of legend, because Colorado is not prepared for a criminal of Bundy's magnitude and intelligence. And I'm not insulting the law enforcement officials of Colorado when I say that. Really, there had been no criminal in U.S. legal history quite like Ted Bundy, and my personal opinion, there has not really been one since. Bundy's charisma, his intelligence, his craftiness, and that secret side of him that it's unknown whether anyone who survived ever really saw, made and continue to make Bundy the source of thousands of books, television, and movies. So Bundy ends up being put in the Pitkin County Jail, where basically he's treated as a celebrity. Ted basically takes over the majority of his own legal counsel. Again, the same thing he did in the Durantia case. He is more forward in this one, doing much of his own legal wranglings and maneuvers, aided by various defenders. Eventually, Bundy's trial is going to be moved to Aspen. Bundy was noted to be extremely confident during his preliminary hearing, when the one eyewitness who had seen the man believed to have taken Karen Campbell on the night of her disappearance and murder pointed to one of the law enforcement officials in the court when asked to identify the man she had seen, as opposed to Ted Bundy. On April 13th, 1977, Ted Bundy is transferred from the Pitkin County Jail to the Garfield County Jail, where he's going to be housed during the course of his trial. On June 7th, 1977, Bundy is transferred, as was normal, from the Garfield County Jail to the Aspen Courthouse, and after a recess for lunch, Bundy was allowed upstairs where he would work in the law library. At some point after this, a woman passing by on the street saw a figure leap from the window of the courthouse, hit the ground, and take off running with a slight limp. She immediately ran inside and asked those inside if it was normal for individuals to jump for their windows, and the officers quickly realized that Ted Bundy had just fled the scene. What nobody realized was that Bundy, who had just gotten himself a new haircut, was also wearing two shirts, and after discarding the shirt that he had worn into court, he quickly blended into Aspen before eventually heading up into the mountains. Obviously, roadblocks and everything else is going on. People are in a panic trying to track down Ted Bundy. They cannot find him. Bundy ends up finding his way to a cabin, which he breaks into, getting some warmer clothing, a little bit of food, as well as a rifle before traveling on. And the way Bundy was able to do all this was, as his own defense lawyer, he was allowed access to all of the things that the prosecution had, including the maps of Colorado that had been found in Bundy's Utah home. And using these, he was trying to get out of Aspen. However, Bundy is unable to do so. Exhaustion, his injured ankle, etc., leads Bundy back to the cabin. Eventually, he makes his way down in Aspen proper, where he steals a car. However, because of his weakened state, Bundy is unable to control the vehicle and is quickly pulled over by deputies who recognize Bundy and place him back under arrest. Monday, June 13th. So now on top of all of his other charges, Ted has charges of escape, stealing, being in possession of a firearm, various other things. Many members of law enforcement said, "We warned them that Bundy was an escape risk, but they wouldn't listen." Bundy now, anytime he is out of his cell, is in leg irons with a leg brace on to keep him from running, as well as shackles on his... These precautions, Ted Bundy's quest for freedom is not over. And in fact, it may actually have helped that he was captured during his first escape attempt, because it gave Bundy more time and opportunity to plan his escape better for a period of time when law enforcement attention was not completely focused on him, but on the outside world. We do know is that Bundy had been able to accumulate roughly $500 inside of his cell, most of it smuggled in by an old acquaintance of his who had now become a new love interest, Carol Ann Boone. Boone was somebody that Bundy had worked with when he worked for the government in Washington State, who had jokingly teased that he may in fact be the Ted they were looking for in the Ted murders. He had also gotten schematics for the Garfield County Jailhouse and from another prisoner a hacksaw blade, which he used to cut away a portion of the ceiling in his cell and access the crawl space up above. Now, there are stories that a jailhouse informant had complained of hearing noises and movement in this area up above the cells in the weeks leading up to December 30th, 1977. However, it does not appear that anyone paid these any heed. So, here's what happens on December 30th, Bundy is the only prisoner kept inside of the jail. All of the others were nonviolent offenders, and he hears the jailer and his wife from his perch up in the crawl space talking about going out to a movie. Bundy suspects, perhaps paranoid, that they may in fact be trying to lure him into a trap. However, when the couple does leave, Bundy goes back to his cell, gets all of his supplies, takes all of his law books and trial papers, places them underneath the blanket inside of his room, and then climbs up through this hole. How he was able to do this was Bundy was known not to eat breakfast, and his jailers had learned that he would often leave his breakfast plate alone, get up for lunch, have dinner, and that would be that. In doing so, Bundy had lost a considerable amount of weight. Crawling through the crawl space, he ends up in the closet above the jailer's apartment. He comes down, takes the jailer's guns, which are inside of this apartment, places them up inside of the crawl space as a precaution in case the jailer should return, and then proceeds to change his clothes, stealing some of the jailer's own clothing, at which point Ted Bundy walks out of the jail. He ends up stealing a car that has the keys in the ignition. However, he is not able to clear the pass that leads out of town. Although a passing trucker picks Bundy up and drives him to Vail, where he catches a bus to Denver. From Denver, Bundy purchases a plane ticket to Chicago. And it was around this point that his jailers in Garfield County realized that something was wrong. Bundy was not responding to their calls. They go inside the cell and discover that he is now missing. Bundy had roughly a 17-hour head start on his captors. He's long gone. He does end up in Michigan for a brief period of time before eventually finding his way down to Tallahassee, Florida, which is where we're going to pick up this case next week, with Ted Bundy having absconded from the Garfield County Jail
in Colorado and seemingly having vanished into thin air. Obviously, the law enforcement officers in Colorado are scrambling and not only trying to find Bundy, but also to cover their ass. Bundy is going to end up in the FBI's 10 most wanted list because of this escape. And it's really this escape and everything that happens afterwards that makes Ted Bundy who he is in the mythos of true crime today. All right, until next time, stay morbid.